W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Police have a suspect in custody after a string of shootings in Arkabutluck, Mississippi, leaves six people dead. Resident Ethan Cash tells News Nation when he heard a gunshot.
I go up to the truck where a guy got shot at, and I check his pulse and everything, make sure he's okay. He's already gone at this point.
More from CBS's Omar Villafranca.
According to sheriff's deputies, the suspect, identified as 52-year-old Richard Dale Crum, fled, but they soon spotted him in a car. After a brief chase, police say Crum was taken into custody. By the time it was all over, police said four more people were found dead, two inside a home and two more outside near the suspect's house.
A U.S. Kurdish operation in northeast Syria takes out an ISIS leader. Details from National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
Last night, U.S. military and SDF partnered forces conducted a helicopter raid against an ISIS senior leader, a man named Hamza al-Hamzi. And he was overseeing the group's deadly terrorist network in eastern Syria before he was killed in the raid.
Four American service members and a worker dog were injured when a U.S. official says Hamzi detonated a suicide vest or booby trap. Five former Memphis police officers have pleaded not guilty to second-degree murder, aggravated assault, kidnapping, and or other charges related to the arrest and death of Tyree Nichols, who was black. The five former officers, who are also black, were fired after a Memphis Police Department investigation into the arrest. Nichols' mother, Rovon Wells, was in court today.
I want each and every one of those police officers to be able to look me in the face. They haven't done that yet. They couldn't even do that today. They didn't even have the courage to look at me in my face.
A man who allegedly shot and wounded two Jewish men as they left synagogues in Los Angeles this week has been charged with federal hate crimes. The 28-year-old suspect is being held without bond. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass says fighting hate crimes is a priority of her administration.
Anti-Semitism has no place in Los Angeles, no place in our country.
In New Mexico, the go-ahead has been given to kill more than 100 wild or feral cows. More from CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman.
The plan by the U.S. Forest Service will target around 150 wild cows. Environmentalists say the cows are damaging ecosystems and are also viewed as a danger to tourists. There is some opposition to the plan. Lauren Patterson is with the New Mexico Cattle Growers Association.
This is not the standards for New Mexico animal agriculture.
The wild cows will be hunted down and shot from helicopters. It will take place over a four-day period. Steve Futterman, CBS News.
The Dow closed up 130 points, NASDAQ down 69.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Muskego to Pewaukee, always streaming at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Authorities in southeast Wisconsin blame yesterday's snowstorm for a 30-car pileup on Interstate 41 near the Washington-Dodge County line. Three people were hurt, but they're all expected to pull through. It took 7 hours to clean up the mess. Republican state lawmakers say they'll start from scratch and draft their own state budget rather than work on what Governor Evers proposed this week.
Certainly the budget's going to look different for where it ends the process from where it started. But, I mean, certainly there's going to be areas of compromise and consensus.
That's Senator Andre Jacques of DePere. The budget is now in the hands of the Joint Finance Committee. In sports, the Bucks beat Chicago last night 112-100. Milwaukee's 12-game winning streak is the longest in the NBA this season. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripes Cast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous Ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
Catch Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow at its brand new time, 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays.
The city of Shanghai started administering an inhalable COVID-19 vaccine. I hear a lot of you saying the same thing I had in my head. I don't know about that.
As long as they're not just crop dusting everyone.
Crop dusting, that's exactly what I think people would be fearful of. I would not trust the Chinese government. I would trust people who really know about inhaling something and the good that it does you. Of course, I'm talking about Dom and Crute.
The Shaw 101 FM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com. The Shaw 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM, Waukesha's only news talk station.
And download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Well, you know, I'm looking at a lot of Republican-led states, and I got to tell you, it appears to me, it appears these Republican-dominated states are moving legislation and wielding power to return states to the good old days, you know, when workers were desperate and poorly educated and, well, the wealthy and powerful ruled the roost. Ah, yes. Repealing the 20th century. And look, this is if you look around and pay attention to what these states are doing, it's all about repealing the 20th century. It's all about restoring power to, well, the rich and powerful. And one of those things that keeps popping up every day, my box is full of stories of child labor again. I cannot believe that we're in a moment where there are forces out there going, you know what? We don't have enough cheap labor. We don't have enough people willing to do these crummy jobs. Let's get the kids to do it. Yeah, bring in the kids, bring in the children. And the thing is, you know, if you know the history of how we fought back against child labor, and you know the history of how horrible things were, I point back to our trip to Scranton during the Working Class Heroes radio tour, where we did the coal mine tour. And the tour guides were talking about what it was like to be a 6-7-year-old working in the mine. Yes, you heard that right. A 6 or 7-year-old working in the mine. And how the 6, 7, 8-year-olds had a 50% fatality rate. You know, I thought we were like, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're better than that. We're going to wait till they get to be 18 before we use and abuse them. Evidently not. And the thing is you go back and you understand the history of what it took and how hard it was to get kids out of the mines and into the classroom. Because, look, you know, everybody wants their kids to learn, you know, good work ethic, wants to learn a value of a buck. Nobody's saying that kids shouldn't do things. When I was a kid, everybody had a paper route. You know, I had a paper route. My friends had paper routes. I had a paper route from the time I was 8 all the way through high school. No one's saying that kids shouldn't learn to be industrious and entrepreneurial, however you want to frame that. It's getting out of these dangerous situations. It's putting the priority on school, on getting ahead and learning a lesson than it is of getting cheap labor. And you go back and you think about, you know, by the early 20th century, you know, we had, you know, some 2 million kids under the age of 16 in the workforce, working 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week. Because we didn't have any maximum hour laws. There were no minimum wage laws. There were no real child labor laws. And it was one of these things where you had to. Kids had to work so the families could survive. There are forces that want to take us back to those days. And you think about the legislation, because we didn't do this out of the goodness. Corporate America didn't do this out of the goodness of their heart. There wasn't a benevolent employer who goes, you know what? Those poor little children, I just love the babies so much, we're not going to use and abuse them in the workplace. That's not how this worked. It wasn't until 1936 that the federal government said, you know what? Contracts over $10,000, we're not going to give anyone a contract if they're using labor under the age of 16. Boys under 16, girls under 18. Yes, we were sexist back then. And that was just through government procurement. That wasn't the entire economy. It took till 1938, the Fair Labor Standards Act, that we finally said, you know, maybe we shouldn't have kids in the workplace. Maybe we should have them in the classrooms. And it said during the year, you know, kids had to be, during the school year, had to be 16 years of age, couldn't do jobs that were considered dangerous by the Secretary of Labor. And this worked for a good long time. But here we're in this moment. We're in this moment where it's getting worse. Because the violations are slap on the wrist at best. In fact, in 2022, child labor violations increased by 37%. And you go, well, how is that possible? Well, a big part of it is we're finally looking for it. So I'm thinking that's part of it. But we've seen some pretty sizable cases where you've got young kids working at Hyundai and Kia. You see them at these meatpacking plants, and you see them, you know, all across the fast food industry. And what we know is younger workers have a much higher rate of injury, have a much higher rate of injuries that need medical attention, and are going to be more likely to not report than anybody else. It's one of those things. And you look across the country. You know, we've been talking about Iowa for the last couple of weeks because Iowa is the most egregious case of all. This idea that we're going to remove a bunch of child labor barriers, and then we're going to issue waivers to companies that are working with an apprenticeship program with the local school. So we're going to create a pipeline from the school to the factories, and then no liability shields. So if the kids get hurt, you know, whose fault is that? School's not going to claim the responsibility. The company's been shielded from liability. Who's going to fall on? Yeah, the kids and the family. Exactly what corporate America wants. But this isn't even just that. I mean, Iowa is one thing. Ohio is moving, has evidently reintroduced a piece of legislation to extend work hours to 14 and 15 year olds. You got Minnesota introduced a bill that would allow 14 and 15 year olds to work during the school year. Wisconsin, you know, the governor there just vetoed a bill that would have expanded work time for 14 and 15 year olds. And you go, when does this stop? It doesn't. Corporate America's insatiable appetite and need for cheap labor, exploitable labor, will never end. And this is where we, you know, parents, citizens, people who were fortunate enough to have a childhood and fortunate enough to have reasonable people say, you know, there's jobs we want you to do and you can do, but you shouldn't be competing with your parents for jobs to support the family. You know, there was a moment in this country where things were pretty good for working families. You know, one income could support a family. You had the breadwinner go out. You had into the workforce. You had someone stay home, take care of the household, take care of the kids, do all the things that needed to be done. You took vacations, got, you know, cars every once in a while. Life was good. Sent the kids off to college. They got good opportunities to move on and do better. And there was this snowball of prosperity for working people. Now, some would say, well, that came at the expense of our billionaires, because we didn't have a lot of billionaires back then. Back didn't have any. Now we got over 1,000, and some of them are just outrageously wealthy, because we've seen a massive redistribution of wealth from the people who actually do the work and create the wealth to the people who, well, I had an idea and I made a bunch of other people do it.
But we give them tax breaks and we socialize their risk and we do all this stuff to ensure that they're well taken care of at the expense of who? Ask yourself, what kind of future do you want for your kids? Look, I want my kids to be able to learn the value of a dollar and get a good work ethic. I do. But there's a moment where you go, I want them safe first. I don't want them exploited, and I don't want them competing with me for the same job. Because that's not how this system should work. But corporate America, that's what they're taking. Now, Ohio is a particularly interesting state because right now Ohio is on a mission to become Mississippi. And well on its way, the Ohio Republicans have introduced their first piece of legislation going to lower the state's income tax and the state's property tax. And you go, well, how are they going to pay for that, Rick? How will Ohio, you know, giving all this wealth away, how's this going to work out? Well, they're going to cut it from education. And you know where the education funding cuts come from? Well, the poorer school districts. Of course it does. And where do you think those poor kids eventually are going to end up? Well, 14, 15 years old, working in the meatpacking plants. I mean, it's amazing to me. Now, today I saw this report from the Department of Labor that this company, Packers Sanitation Services Incorporated, they just got fined $1.5 million in penalties. And you go, wow, that's a lot. What'd they get fined for? Well, it turns out the company used at least 102 children from the ages of 13 to 17 doing hazardous work. What's hazardous? You know, being around hazardous chemicals, cleaning the meat processing supplies, the back saws, the brisket saws, the head splitters. You know, just going in there and getting there because you got little hands fit in those little spaces can clean things really well. Now you go, wow, that's a lot of money. $1.5 million, a lot of money. No, it works out to about $15,000 a head. So about $15,000 for every violation. And you go, that doesn't seem like a lot. You read further into the report, that's the maximum penalty that you can give. So even if they had a six-year-old working in there, the maximum penalty is $15,138. And you go, why aren't we locking people up? Because we don't do that to employers. We don't lock them up. We don't. And, you know, OSHA, you know, the most serious violation that you get there is not a little bit more than $14,000 for the most serious. If you die on the job, if you get killed, it's only 70 grand. That's the maximum fee. So I've often said, and I've said this for years, if I ever really wanted to kill someone, I would just hire them. I would give them a job and set up a dangerous situation that, you know, I know they're gonna fall into and collapse on them, and it would only cost me 70 grand. Now that I've said this out loud, there goes my grandmaster plan. But this is how crazy our labor laws have become. This is how crazy this stuff is. And you go, you know, but Rick, you know, they're a big company. It could have been, you know, a mistake. Yeah, a lot of these plants, because there were a number of plants across the country that this Packers Sanitation Services owns and runs. There were a couple of them that had one violation. And you go, okay, that could have been a mistake. It could have been a paperwork mix-up. You know, someone, you know, was desperate and, you know, tried to get their kid in there because the family needed the money. That you could almost see. But in three locations, you had one had 22, one had 26, one had 27 underage kids working in their place. You go, now that's a little more systematic. That seems like, well, somebody's recruiting these kids and someone's not doing their jobs. But here's the thing, and this is where this is the other part of this. It's only 15 grand. It's $15,000 in penalties for hiring these kids who you probably hired at half the wage with no benefits. So how much did the companies make? And is this really a penalty? Is it really something that's a big deal? Now, you got this trampoline park in Jacksonville, Florida. They just got fined $43,000 for violating 55 minor-aged kids and the law there. Worked them after 7 p.m., cheated them out of overtime. The general churn. A little slap on the wrist. Don't do it again. Post a notice. And, you know, that's sadly what our labor laws have become over the years. And this is why I get so frustrated and go, look, this is the reason you need to join and form unions. This is the reason we need a strong, vibrant labor movement, because this stuff doesn't happen in unionized workplaces. And the places that are trying to organize, they're screwing them over, too. I look at Starbucks. Starbucks story just came out about Starbucks. They fired two people in connection with the Philadelphia campaign to organize, according to the National Labor Relations Board. So these two people, they're going to get their jobs back probably with back pay. But the penalties for this are non-existent. So they get fired. Okay, so let's say you worked 40 hours a week at $10 an hour. That's $400 a week. So you're off, you know, 10 weeks, that's $4,000 that the company would have to pay at the most. Now, if you went out and got a job making $3,000, they only owe you $1,000. Our laws are so boogered up and so screwy that it would be, if you're a lawyer advising these companies on how to break the union, it's almost malpractice to not tell them to fire people. Because the victory of putting the chilling effect in the workplace and scaring the hell out of everybody else so that they don't vote for a union, it much weighs out the negatives of having to pay a couple of bucks on the other side and then promising you won't do it again until, of course, the next time you do it. And this is where I keep coming back to the reality of how bad our labor law is. And I talk to people who go, well, you know, if I got fired illegally, I'd just, you know, file a lawsuit. And you, good luck on that. You know how often that works? Almost never. This, again, why we need to have strong labor unions. Because this stuff doesn't happen. People don't get cheated out of wages. And when they do, there's someone to fight for them. You don't feel like you're out on an island. And, you know, for me, there's this moment where I'm hoping all of this stuff people are paying attention to. The fact that we're really talking about putting kids back in dangerous jobs. We're talking about putting them back into dangerous jobs with immunity for employers. I mean, it's mind-blowing. But as I say, you know, they want to take us back to the good old days. Back to the Lochner era, before there were any rules to abusing workers at all. Back to where if you wanted to work 100 hours for, you know, a buck an hour, that was your right. It was your liberty. It was your freedom. There are folks who want to do this again. And six of them are sitting on our Supreme Court. So when these things come up to challenge, when states pass this horrible, and it's the reason it's happening, they know the Supreme Court's not going to step in. There's no backstop here. The only backstop, an aggressive, strong, powerful labor movement. That a militant movement of working people, not ideologues, not right-left hat wearers, but actual people who want to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and opportunities for their kids. We're on the wrong path, folks. On the wrong path. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I'm looking at Donald Trump. Evidently, Donald Trump wants to embrace mail-in balloting now. Evidently, and look, this is a Republican thing now. They're now coming around to the idea that, well, you know, you know, this mail-in ballot, maybe we should, I don't know, think about it. The report came out from the Wall Street Journal that Trump's team is studying state laws governing absentee and mail-in voting, as well as ballot collection, called ballot harvesting, in which third parties gather and turn in votes. People familiar with the effort said. So basically, they're going to try and go, hey, we work for Democrats. Maybe we shouldn't be against helping people vote. And you go, you know, this is the weird thing. And I always wondered about this, why Republicans didn't gather on to the idea of mail-in voting and ballot harvesting as well. It was mind-blowing to me because they're better organized, much better organized than the Democrats are. If you remember when Sam Alito was going through the nomination process to get on the Supreme Court, they had these Justice Sunday things where they were linking up thousands of churches on these video conference calls and how they were going to get out there and they were going to fight for their man, Alito, so that he could get on the Supreme Court. And they were outwardly saying it. You know, Alito's going to be the guy who's going to, you know, do all the things we want, like end abortion and, you know, go after those people and, you know, make you know, God great again. And they were literally linking up thousands of churches. And I remember saying back then, you know, Democrats, you better pay attention to what they're doing because they are doing a masterful job of on the ground, old school organizing. You know, I remember an interview years and years ago with the guy Ralph Reed, where someone had asked him, you know, how did you build your grand religious coalition of insaniacs? And he pulled out the SWOC handbook, the Steelworkers Organizing Committee handbook, and said, you know, here it is, old school labor organizing, face to face. You know, hand to hand, door to door, worker to worker organizing, bringing people together, coalescing around common ideas. And Democrats haven't done that. They've done really a crummy job of it. And you look at what Republicans have been able to do through media, through academia. I mean, look, they claim, you know, every campus is liberals. And you go, I don't know. Most of the professors I had going through college were staunch conservatives. Most of my high school teachers were staunch conservatives. This idea that they're all hippie liberals pushing, you know, indoctrination is a nice narrative, but not the reality. But this is what they get to do when they build the organizing campaign around creating their own truth, alternative facts, alternative realities, you know. So for me, it was curious why Republicans didn't grab onto it. Okay, we want ballot harvesting? Sure. We'll make sure that everyone in the church is registered, and we'll make sure that they hand us the ballot. In fact, we'll have Ballot Sunday, where we can have people come in and we'll help them fill out their ballots. It's always curious why they didn't do that, but now kind of changing their tune, because you look here in Pennsylvania, where Doug Mastriano just got slaughtered in the polls. The ballot wasn't even close. He got beat worse than any gubernatorial candidate in this state in my lifetime. And a big part of it is the fact that Shapiro got more than 1 million mail-in votes, and Mastriano just got like 187,000. I mean, it was over 5-1 in favor of Shapiro. Now you go, well, those people just didn't show up to the poll. And there's truth to that. What Republicans have always tried to do is put that barrier between people in the ballot box. But by giving them the ability to do it from home, the number of votes went up. That's what Republicans are afraid of. And now kind of changing their tune a little bit. Because even Mastriano on some right-wing talk show in Philadelphia, he said, look, you know, I didn't embrace it. You know, obviously, during the campaign, we probably should have used it as the Democrats ad, because I don't see how we win elections without embracing that idea. And you got Trump now saying kind of the same thing. So the Republican talking point now is kind of going to be come around to a different idea of, you know, maybe we should be embracing this stuff. Because, again, they've got the organizing to do it. Now, they continue, they embrace this, they got their organizing part, and continue all of the assaults on voting rights like they did in Georgia and they've done in other places, keep putting those barriers between, you know, certain groups of people, mostly poor people, and the ballot box. They see that as their way to victory. Because look, if as long as they can keep the number of people voting down, they know they got a shot. But when we all vote, they lose, and they lose badly because their ideas are bad. Their policy aims are horrible. That's the reality of the world that we're in, and they know it as well as anyone, which is why you're seeing the schemes to stop people from voting. Like, oh, let's not let 18-year-olds vote. Raise the age to 21 because they don't want college kids voting.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk from Big Bend to Menominee Falls. Always streaming at WAUKradio.com.
CBS News Brief. In Arca Butler, Mississippi, resident Ethan Cash saw what turned out to be just one in a string of deadly shootings, telling News Nation.
I look out the window and I see, you know, dude walking back here with a shotgun.
Six people killed. The suspect is in custody. Hamza al-Hamzi, leader of the ISIS terrorist network in Syria, is dead. But some American troops have been injured in the northeast Syria mission. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
An explosion during the raid also resulted in four U.S. troops and one other working dogs suffering some injuries.
Not guilty pleas entered today for five former Memphis police officers in the death of Tyree Nichols. Nichols' mother and stepfather were also in court. Their attorney, Ben Crump.
They didn't even have the courage to look at her in her face, and that's what she came to the courtroom to see today. Them look her and her face eye to eye. How could you do this to my son?
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
WAUK 540 AM. Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. The Western Wisconsin nurse accused of cutting off a dying patient's foot appeared in court yesterday. Mary Brown pleaded not guilty to charges of mayhem and physical abuse of an elderly person. Last May, witnesses said Brown removed the victim's right foot, which had become necrotic from severe frostbite. She did not have a doctor's permission, and the patient did not request it. Brown said she did it to make the man more comfortable. The Oscar Mayer Wienermobile's catalytic converter was stolen during a weekend appearance in Las Vegas. Thieves have been targeting vehicles' catalytic converters over the past few years because they contain rhodium, which is nearly 10 times as valuable as gold. KLAS-TV reporting the vehicle was towed to a repair shop with a temporary catalytic converter installed. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
Civic Media promised you something big to celebrate our new and still growing network of radio stations. When we announced the one-day $1 million advertising giveaway for Wisconsin businesses, you responded.
Just wanted to echo your sentiments about the advertising. That's really a cool deal and really remarkable.
$1 million of free advertising. Now, if you missed this chance to work with our team, go to civicmedia.us and click on the sponsorship tab. One of our local sales pros will get right back to you. Civicmedia.us and sponsorship.
Governor Tony Evers, Tim Michaels said you had gone, quote, full woke. Dr. Jill Underley said that somebody who says that has no idea what we're doing in schools to make sure kids feel safe.
We want to make sure all kids feel supported. Tim Michaels, we don't teach CRT in our schools. You got to come to the present century here, Tim, and be cognizant of what actually goes in the schools. My guess is you've never been in a public school in Wisconsin.
Up North News Radio with Pat Krylo airs at its new time from 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays across Civic Media.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold, 1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003. 125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football. You're about to find out. Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Monday mornings at 8 on The Shaw and on the Civic Media app.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
This example of loving, creative people going the other way. Happy Valentine's Day. The height.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, I've been getting tons of email on this on the derailment and asking the question, where's the federal government been? And yesterday on the program, we talked about the response from the DOT, from EPA being there almost immediately, and how the reality is that this falls on the states. The governor has to request a lot of this other stuff, and oh boy, no one happy with that response. But hey, that's how our system is set up. I love my conservative friends who taught me they believe in states' rights, and then when I say this is a states' rights issue, not happy about it. I'm here to share some thoughts on what's going on and on the ground in East Palestine, and what the federal government is, can, and should be doing, and what we should be doing long-term in the aftermath of this. I've asked Congressman Chris DeLuzio to come talk with us. Congressman represents the 17th Congressional District here in Pennsylvania. Congressman, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for having me on.
So let's start with the first point there. As I understand it, FEMA or the EPA was there, DOT was there. There were a number of federal agencies on the ground when this happened. As they were supposed to. This is how the gig works, right? FEMA's not jumping in. The federal government isn't taking these things over. These are states' issues, right?
Yeah, and look, on my side of the border in Pennsylvania, and for folks who don't know, people I represent in Beaver County in Pennsylvania were evacuated. They were within that zone, like the folks in East Palestine were. My governor, Josh Shapiro, anything that the state has needed from the federal government, they're getting. And part of my job and the senators who I'm working with is to make sure that's happening. And I understand on the Ohio side, same thing, whether it's EPA, CDC, the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, that's who's going to do and is doing the investigation. They're doing it. And anything that we're getting asked from our state counterparts, we're making sure is delivered to these folks. And frankly, that's gone right from the president that whatever the federal government needs to do, they're there.
So let me ask you straight out then. The reporting that I'm getting is that the people aren't getting what they need and that there's some failure by the administration. So what are the conditions on the ground? You were there. What did you see?
Look, people are scared. People are mad. And people are worried about their water and their air, their animals, right? And so part of what I'm trying to get out to folks and what I saw is there is testing, air and water. If you want it in your house and you're in that area, it's there. And the federal government's doing the air side of it. The state EPs are doing the water. Those tests are there, and I've been telling people, request them. My office, the Republican across the way in Ohio, same thing. They're there to help people get them, and that's what people ought to do so they feel safe.
Yeah.
And so now, that's the most important thing the government could be doing here is making sure your water and your air is safe, your animals and wildlife are safe.
Now, I'm looking at some of the bomb throwers in Congress, some of your colleagues who are saying, this is all Biden's fault, evidently. There must have been an executive order, who knows. But this is all Biden's fault. It's all the federal government's fault because evidently the water is not safe to drink and they want Biden to drink the water. I'm sure you've seen all this craziness. Yeah. Is this helpful?
Look, it's partisan crap. That's what these guys do. They're fundraising off this stuff. They're looking to get reelected off this stuff. And by the way, if they want to go back and look at history, and I've been in the Congress now, I guess, 6 weeks. You want to go back a couple of years. It was Donald Trump and the Republicans carrying water for the railroads, whether it was, rules around staffing, safety, this precision scheduled railroading doctrine, which is right out of Wall Street, where they're extracting every penny of profit they can on the backs of their workers and everything else and our safety. That's the GOP doing the work of these railroads. And that's the environment in which we have derailments like this, where these railroads are stretching their trains longer. I mean, look, let's be even pretty direct. This railroad and others lobbied against a two-person staffing requirement. And luckily, there were three workers on this train that derailed. I've heard direct from the union representing those folks. If there weren't three of them on there, if there had been one, they would have been able to take the action they did to help mitigate how bad this could have been. So there are real consequences for this, corporate lobbying and frankly, bootlicking we're seeing on the right.
Yeah, I mean, both the trains, one in East Palestine and the one outside of Detroit that derailed. Because again, these derailments are not as infrequent as we're led to believe. They happen quite often. Fortunately, we don't have ones as big as what happened in East Palestine. But this 9,300 feet long. I mean, this is like a mile and a half long train. I don't know how only three people can care for that, but good on those workers for being able to, but shame on the industry for forcing them to.
Well, and look, these workers have been beat up for a while. I mean, good luck taking a day of sick leave in that job, which is a tough job on top of everything else. And I think that there is going to be a lot more awareness of how hard this job is. And frankly, that these workers have been sounding the alarm about this industry.
Yeah.
The place I represent, Western PA, like a lot of places in this country, these tracks run through our neighborhoods. They run through our towns. So many of us live close to them. And people are scared about whether this might happen again. I'm sure it will happen somewhere again. But we got to make it so that this isn't the norm. And that when this does happen, that these railroads are held accountable. And they make every single person, business, you name it, whole for what they've done.
Now, I find it interesting, and I look at some of your colleagues, some of the bomb throwers, who, you know, the anti-government folks who are out now screaming, you know, they ran on government shouldn't do anything, can't do anything, we need to privatize everything, now screaming that the government isn't, in their view, doing anything. I find it interesting that people who don't believe in government, when things happen like this, are the first ones to scream and complain that government isn't doing anything. It just seems odd to me.
Well, Rick, here's a basic way to test that. Do you want Norfolk Southern and their contractors to test your water? Or do you want your state Environmental Protection Department? Of course you want your state doing that. People don't trust this railroad that just wrecked their neighborhoods. The government is there to do that testing because they don't have a financial stake in this. Whereas you've got a railroad who wants to show that their harms were less than they actually caused, less they got to end up paying for this. So I think it's an important lesson in rebuilding some trust and faith in the agencies that are designed to keep us safe and take care of us when something like this, God forbid, happens again.
Now, here's the thing, though, Congressman. You know, over the summer, we were talking with a number of the rail unions about their contract. And the first thing that's going to get thrown up at you is, well, the president didn't do enough to get those workers' sick days, didn't listen to the warnings that were being thrown out. In this environment, it appears to me the only people who got it right were the workers who were saying, hey, we're not working in safe conditions. Hey, look at this. And sadly, now I guess I should pose this as a question: will we learn from this, or will this be another instance where it's just, hey, bad things happened, and once it's out of the news cycle, it goes away?
I think we have to learn from this. I think we will. I mean, what I'm seeing and hearing on the ground in PA across the border in Ohio is people are fired up for something to change. I'm hearing it across the country. I'm hearing it from my colleagues in the House. And, you know, the workers here have been sounding the alarm about this industry, about this precision scheduled railroading, this PSR idea that just maximizes operational efficiency at whatever cost, driven by Wall Street. So I think we're going to be looking hard at what this industry is doing, not just in this specific derailment, but how we prevent the next one. And so that we're not in this situation again, especially when we're hearing it direct from the people who make these railroads run, who do that hard work day in, day out about how we can be safer.
So, but here's the thing, you know, the question then comes down to, you know, what are we going to do? I mean, you tweeted out today, railroads have been squeezing every penny of profit they can at the expense of safety. I'll be fighting for you to hold Norfolk Southern accountable. Great. I want to hear that. But what are you going to do? How do we, we've given so much power to this industry. We've allowed industry after industry across the country to consolidate and almost monopolize. And that we've given them such enormous power to regulate themselves and police themselves, because there are some who believe, well, government shouldn't be policing. The companies, they'll do what's in their best interest. And I agree, they do, in their own best interest, not ours. How will you hold them accountable? And is there an appetite, since Democrats don't hold the House, to actually hold hearings and to actually get to the bottom of this?
I hope so. You know, I don't know the answer to that yet, of whether the Republicans who control these committees now are going to be tough on these guys. I hope so. I think there's bipartisan interest here. Jury's still out. We'll see. I'm hoping my Republican colleagues are there with us. The things I'd want to see, you know, in the Congress is we got to look at these staffing levels. We got to look at all of these ways in which the railroads here are stretching to do what they want to do to keep their, you know, operating efficiency at the highest possible point, stretching out the length of these trains, the number of cars, the kinds of notifications we give to towns, what qualifies as hazardous materials, what that means the railroads have to do. And then, of course, there's the real stuff of the EPA and others making sure that this railroad pays every penny it has to make people whole. Now, I can't control that in the Congress, but I can push the agencies to do exactly that. I know my governor and the team in Harrisburg and Pennsylvania are doing their part on the state side as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's an awful lot to this. But it comes down to me, Congressman, of a basic philosophy. This idea that, you know, and I've had a bunch of conservatives yelling at me that, you know, because I've been advocating for, you know, regulating these industries for years. you know, this idea that regulations are job killers. And I look at this and I go, you know, how many people could have been killed had this gone even worse than it went? So for me, the lack of regulation, to me, is scarier than a couple of extra regulations.
Well, look, if the Republicans want to be the corporate bagmen, they want to be the party that's all about mergers and these huge corporations ripping us off, they should do that, and we'll own them every November. Because the people of this country, I don't care if you're conservative, left, you name it, they're tired of getting ripped off. They're tired of getting pushed around, and workers are tired of not being able to form and join a union and have some say on the job. So if the Republicans want to go fight online, you know, culture war stuff and carry water for huge corporations like Norfolk Southern, go do it. And we'll own you and we'll run this country for people.
Good stuff. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Pennsylvania Congressman Chris DeLuzio. He represents Pennsylvania's 17th congressional district. I want to change topics real quick and get congratulate you on doing something that I've been saying Democrats need to do every day, and that's adopt a striker. The people out of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette have been on strike for, it's several months now. And you took one of the striking workers to the State of the Union address, and good on you for doing that. What made you make that choice?
Well, in my area, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's the paper of record by most accounts, and the ownership there has just been in a brutal fight against their workers for a long, long time. Now, these folks have been without a contract, I think, since 2017. They haven't had a pay raise in more than 16 years. And, the owners pulled their health care, and that was enough. They went on strike, and they've been out for more than 4 months now. I was on the picket with those guys this week, and I brought with me as my State of the Union guest down to Washington, Hutchie Van Landingham, one of the mailers at the paper, who's a third-generation worker there. And, this newspaper has been central to our region. They've done great reporting and work over time, but, this current generation of owners doesn't seem to respect the folks who make that paper run, and those workers are fighting. And what I wanted to do was not just, honor Hutchie and these other workers, but bring their fight to the national stage. I mean, people have to listen to what they're standing up for, and frankly, what workers across this country are fighting for as we see more and more strikes, more and more elections, and workers winning those elections.
Yeah, it's great to see, but the sad reality is our labor laws are so badly broken and ossified that I fear that, while we're winning elections and we're seeing all this energy, it doesn't equate to contracts, and it doesn't equate to making lives better. And that's my fear when the employers have this much outweighted power, even with a president who says, he's the most pro-labor, and I don't disagree with him, the most pro-labor president in my lifetime. Our laws are that bad that, people who want to join and form unions, it's a Herculean leap where it shouldn't be.
Well, that's absolutely right, and I agree. And I was born in 1984. Joe Biden is easily the most pro-union president of my life, but it doesn't change the fact that we need the PRO Act. For folks who don't know what that is, right? It changes so that we get to an equal playing field for workers to form and join a union. So if a company union busts, they actually have some meaningful penalties. For now, you fire someone who's organizing and maybe you have to pay back wages months, years down the road. That's not enough of a deterrent. It's not enough of a penalty. Okay. And we know, and anyone who's fought for a union knows, those penalties are too weak, and it's too hard to do, especially if you're in a small shop.
Because this is where I'm telling my Democratic friends, folks like you, we need champions right now. Because if you look at what's going on the other side, I'm looking at Iowa. Iowa is right now talking about putting children back into dangerous workplaces and creating an environment where employers can hire children liability free. It's like we're going back to the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s.
Yeah, that's nuts. And look, here's a part of this too for why the PRO Act is so important from where I sit. If we pass the PRO Act, the right to work anti-worker laws across the state go away, or across the states go away. The states that have them, those laws are repealed if we pass the PRO Act. Because what happens is you have such a different landscape state to state where workers in these anti-union states have very few rights, nothing. And as we see manufacturing starting to trickle back to this country, states like mine, where you have a little more dignity as a worker, you have a little more rights to join and form a union, those employers aren't going to bring the job to states like mine. They're going to go the lowest common denominator where they got the most power over their workers.
No, and the way I've been saying for a long time is how we reunite this country is we bring those jobs back because people want those jobs. But more importantly, people don't want factory jobs and manufacturing jobs as much as they want union jobs, as much as they want jobs that pay a good wage with health care and retirement security and job security and being part of a family, of building a community. That's what people are pining for, not those dirty factory jobs that I remember as a kid, but it was the opportunities that it gave them. That's what people want.
Yeah, look, it's the basic pitch of what this American dream is supposed to be. You work hard, you play by the rules, you get a decent life, you go to the doctor when you're sick, your kids go to school, you can retire with dignity. That isn't the reality for too many people in this country, and I'm hoping to be part of doing something to change that.
I'm hoping for you too. Last question I've got for you, back to the derailment. What are we looking at in the next couple of days? How are you seeing things play out? Do you have any thoughts of what we should be watching out for?
Well, we're still in this, as the EPA describes it, this kind of emergency phase, where we're doing everything as the government, federal, state, local, to keep people safe, to address these chemicals that were released. That's even before we get into the longer term remediation and mitigation phase of this. So we aren't there yet. So for now, it's making sure folks are safe and feel safe. That's testing air and water, making sure it's okay to be in your home. That's where we are. And this cleanup is really focused on this emergency phase. And there's going to be a long-term, frankly, effort. And I've heard the president's cabinet and the president say the federal government is here as long as it takes, and they got to be. The reps on the other side of the border and me in Pennsylvania were making sure they are, because, you know, these people who were affected, my constituents and the folks in Ohio, they deserve to be able to live their lives, not worried about their health, their kids' health. And I think this government got to do everything it can to deliver that.
Absolutely. Representative, I appreciate you taking time for me. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts as this continues to down the road. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
Good stuff, Congressman Chris DeLuzio. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1932. That was the day that working people in the United States said goodbye to one of their great heroes. Florence Kelly was born in 1859. Her father, William D. Kelly, was a U.S. senator. Senator Kelly was an abolitionist and was concerned about the conditions under which working people toiled. He passed that concern on to his daughter. Florence enjoyed the finest education, studying at Cornell University, the University of Zurich, and the Union College of Law. She became a vocal opponent of child labor and sweatshop conditions. She found camaraderie with like-minded women, including Jane Addams and Ellen Gates Starr, at Hull House in Chicago. Kelly soon became an important addition to the work of this famed settlement house. Jane Addams' nephew remembered her as the finest rough-and-tumble fighter for the good life of others that Hull House ever knew. She began to visit local factories around Hull House to document unsafe working conditions and the use of child labor. Based on her careful research, the Illinois legislature passed a law banning children under the age of 14 from working in factories. Florence was named the first ever chief factory inspector in the state of Illinois. From Chicago, she moved on to New York, where she helped to found the National Consumer League. The league supported the fight for the 8-hour workday and was a leader in the fight against sweatshops. Florence was also a founding member of the NAACP. She helped to found the National Child Labor Committee, a group dedicated to ending child labor. In response to their work, in 1912, the U.S. Children's Bureau became part of the federal government. It was the only federal agency at the time run by women. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So it's being reported that on Wednesday, Donald Trump is going to be visiting East Palestine, Ohio. And you go, why? Why is that? What can he possibly bring to East Palestine that would be helpful. Is he going to bring a box of paper towels with him? I mean, is that what's going to happen? You're going to be throwing out the magic paper towel roll? I mean, is this what we're going to see? And it's, or is it really just about ego? Because he doesn't bring any resources with him. It's all about ego. And he's not going to bring anything helpful. All he's going to do is clog up the area with more hot air and not helpful. And this is the thing. This is the thing about my conservative friends who love to complain. Well, what has Joe Biden done? Joe Biden's done his job. His job is to support the states, get them what they need, get the EPA out there, get the Department of Transportation out there, and the machinery doing what it's supposed to be doing. That's happening. And to be honest, this is what Biden does, his job. We don't need to see mean tweets. We don't need to see, hey, look at how wonderful a job I'm doing. And this is what drives Republicans crazy. Because they need attention. They need to be fed with attention. It's not enough to do the right thing. It's they need the affirmation. They need the, oh, you're so wonderful. And again, this comes back down to that whole Christian extremist thing too. You know, I grew up in the Catholic Church at a time when they talked about peace and social justice, and that your good works shouldn't be something you display, which is why when we do charitable work, when we donate to charities, which we do every year, I never say who I donate to. I never want anything back. I never want someone to say, oh, look how wonderful you were. I do it because it's the right thing to do. Do it because I want to. And again, this comes back to my whole, I got into a whole bunch of trouble saying that we should be taxing churches, which I believe. I don't donate to a church or to a charitable organization because I want a tax break. Donate it because I think they do good work and I want them to continue to do good work. The tax break just comes because, well, we've made that policy because evidently some need that affirmation. And this is another thing. I mean, you know, the Republican Party's hatred of government is, well, on display. Because evidently, according to them, everything's Biden's fault. And this is where this gets weird, because understand, a lot of this is their deregulation religion, their fetish of deregulating and allowing corporate America to do whatever it is they want. And, you know, they've used their media empire to do this, which is why I think it's so important right now that people pay attention what's going on with this lawsuit with the voting machine companies, with Dominion and the other one. Why it's so important to pay attention to what's being said in the court. Now, remember, all during the 2020, there was election fraud and, you know, the Giuliani out there, you know, making these wild, bizarre claims, and Sidney Powell making these really bizarre claims. I said, you know, I don't listen to anything they say at the Four Seasons Landscaping parking lot. Believe nothing there. What did they walk into court, put their hand on the Bible, swear to tell the whole truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help them, the God that they claim to love so much. What do they say then? That's what you pay attention to. And for me, it's what those lawyers bring into court, because there are consequences for not telling the truth. So now when the F channel has come forth with all of this information, and we now find out what I've been saying for years, that none of these people believe the BS that they're spewing. It's all about the money. It's all about duping the poorly educated into continuing to consume the outrage candy. It's the same thing with right-wing radio. It's the same thing with a lot of media portions. It's about getting you angry enough that I can't turn away. I've got to consume more. I got to have more, because I got to have more information to attack those people at work. Or this is what they were masterful at. My question now becomes, all of the dupes and you know, people, you know, with their mouth open on the toilet doing their research, watching Hannity, will they believe what he said? Will those people believe what the F channel said in court, and that they're not news, they're entertainment, and that they didn't buy the election fraud stuff? They tried to get a reporter fired because, well, you know, that reporter challenged the president. It's bad for our stock price. Will they believe it? Or sadly, what I know is going to happen, They're not going to believe what was said in court. They're not going to believe, because that's, you know, it's court, it's government's bad. Because they've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to think anything that government has to do with bad. What I see on the F channel, oh, more. We're in scary times. But the stuff going on in court, everyone should be paying attention to. And look, fortunately, I think there's a chance that the F channel, oh, they're effed. They're the F channel, all right.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.